The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Okay, so this morning I'd like to talk about the quality of the attention that we bring to each moment. So just like fabric or food or a recording can be of higher or lower quality, right? Our attention also has a gradation of quality to it. And we can learn to detect, actually, the state of the quality of our attention. And I think other people can detect it too, that it matters in our interactions what the quality of our attention that we're bringing is. So first, this term that I'm using, high-quality attention, what is that? This kind of attention is stable, so not wavering, I would say. And it has both depth and lightness to it. Does that make sense? So there's some substance and strength to high-quality attention, but it's not heavy and penetrating, you know, boring into the object that we're looking at. It's also open, receptive, allowing, not colored by views and judgments. So this, does that make sense? As sort of a high fidelity to attention. And sometimes, you know, sometimes we've experienced that probably. Mindfulness and Dharma practice have the effect of increasing the quality of our attention over time. I've also found that practice makes me more sensitive to the noticing the quality of the of attention in both myself and others, and I find that I have come to value it. So over time I've started to value simply having higher quality attention, maybe at least as much as valuing, probably more than valuing what's actually happening, is what's that attention. So it's interesting and useful to notice and learn about what distracts or prevents or interferes from having high-quality attention. This is often the way we end up practicing in Buddhism, is that we have something that we're interested in, and then we end up running into everything that is preventing that or is stopping that, and so we have to get familiar with that and work with that also. I heard this phrase on around advertising a circus performance, and the phrase is "live without a net." And I think in that context, it was supposed to mean that we're supposed to be impressed that somebody would be doing acrobatics without a safety net beneath them in the circus. Truthfully, that sounds unwise to me. But I realized when I read the phrase that it was really perfect for Dharma practice. And I think live without a net is what we move toward in practice, in a sense. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what are the nets that we might be using. I'm using the word net to mean something that we bring in to an encounter as an extra, or some kind of unseen prop that we're carrying with us, yeah? And it lowers the quality of our attention to have these other things, something kind of hanging in the wings or strung beneath us in some way, not really as a beneficial support, but more as an appendage or as something awkward. And it's not an accident that a net is also something that can bind us up. So when nets like this are not seen that we're bringing into encounters, then they can tie us up and lower the quality of the intention. So I want to talk a little bit about the nets in our life, if you will, distractions that we have. So I'll start with something that's actually called a net, which is the internet. Sometimes, I'm sure you've had conversations like that, where the internet is kind of like an additional participant in the conversation that we're having with someone. Or maybe it's just our phone, you know, just the presence of our phone is this kind of tentacle out into the world. And basically, you know, when something arrives on the tentacle, then we instantly turn to that sort of trumping the real world interaction that we're having. So this is, I think, is a mark of low quality attention. We're basically saying that anything else is more important than the actual person in front of us. And I know we may not mean it that way, but that can have that implication. I learned about a couple of interesting studies lately that point toward what happens in the presence of a mobile device in conversations. So in the October issue of Social Psychology, there's an experiment described where participants were asked to quickly scan a row of digits and cross out consecutive numbers that add up to some specified total. So like they're supposed to go along and cross out any consecutive digits that add up to 4 or something like that. And before they started, half the participants were asked to turn off their phone and put it away. And the other half were asked to place their phones on the desk. It was ostensibly to answer a few questions about its features. But anyway, the effect was that the phone was sitting there on the desk with them. And no phones went off during the experiment. Everything was silent. But people who had the phone sitting on the desk with them, they performed about 20% worse than the people who didn't have a phone, invisible. So it affects us cognitively. Yeah. And then there's also a study that was done through Virginia Tech that was more naturalistic. I think they were just observing people. Not quite as controlled, but they had 100 dyads that were randomly asked to discuss either a casual or a meaningful topic together. And then a research assistant observed them unobtrusively from a distance during the course of a 10-minute conversation. And they noted whether none, one, or both of the people had their phone out during this. And I think it was just whether or not they naturally placed the phone on the desk or on the table between them. And then they talked with people afterwards about the quality of their experience in this conversation. And people who had a phone present rated the conversation as lower quality than the other than the people who didn't have a phone present. And they also, who had conversations in the absence of the mobile device, they reported higher levels of empathetic concern for the person that they were talking with. So there's also an emotional effect of having a phone present. So we see that, you know, these mobile devices affect both cognitive and emotional experience. But I'll also add another experience of my own. This is just a single case, but it's from a time when I was volunteering as a spiritual caregiver in the hospital, and I was visiting a woman who had a trach in. So she had she was not able to talk. She was breathing through a tube in her throat, and obviously she wasn't going to be speaking with me. I realized that right when I walked in, I was like, oh, okay. So I just sat down. And then she picked up her phone and she typed into it, and she had a text-to-voice program. And she pressed the button and the phone said, hello. And I said, oh, okay, we are going to have a conversation. And we had this lovely conversation where I would speak and then she would type into her phone and press the button and it would speak what she had typed. So actually, the mobile device enhanced the interaction greatly. I mean, that would not have been possible even 10 years ago, say. That would have been much more difficult to have these sophisticated text-to-voice programs. So it was kind of a source of delight for both of us, actually, to have the mobile phone there, right? So what was different? You know, what's different between these cases I've been describing? In the first cases, those experiments, the device had the role of distraction, right? It was something that was representing the whole rest of the world. It was, not kind of drawing attention away from the actual interaction. And in the second case, the mobile device was a servant to the interaction, if you will. Yeah, it was, the interaction was primary, and the device was being used to serve that, to enhance that. So the quality of the attention was a lot higher in the case, in the hospital case. because it was rooted in the present moment, basically. So I'm sure you can, so that's a fairly clear difference. So maybe that will inspire you in some way to figure out how to carry the devices through your life in a way that's enhancing and not distracting, because, you know, we don't want to be 20% less cognitively able by having our device there. Of course, if it were just external devices that were distractions to, the nets that we carry around, that would actually be a pretty easy problem to solve. But in fact, there are distracting elements also that are internal, not external, right? So I'll talk about a few of those. One of the biggest ones that we carry into our interactions is the past. Yeah? So important and often unseen components of conversations are the past associations that are coming up based on what's happening now, right? So for instance, someone that we meet might resemble an old romantic partner or college roommate, and then that brings in some emotions or reactions that are associated with that older experience and not necessarily relevant to what's happening now. And that, you know, those are kind of obvious examples. If we see someone that we say, oh my gosh, that looks just like, and we know who it is. But it can also happen subconsciously if the association is more subtle, like the person walks the way somebody we used to know walks, and it might not be obvious that that's what we're picking up, or if they have an accent that sounds like someone else, then we may not connect with that so consciously. So this is how our psychology works, right? And I think it's not so much that we need to delve into the psychology and figure out what relationship issues are coming up through this past association, although that there are times when that's important. But there's also kind of a dharmic approach of simply noticing that this is how perception works in the mind. So perception works through seeing things that we recognize from the past. And so past experience automatically comes into present moment experience. And there's, you know, we need to A, be mindful of that, and B, have some wisdom about whether the past associations coming up are actually relevant or are they not, right? And if we lack sufficient mindfulness or wisdom in that particular moment, then the past association divides our attention and it can drain away energy, and it generally lowers the quality of the attention that we have because we have this other thing going on. And then we're not able to respond as truly to the person or the situation that's actually happening in the present. Another thing that comes in is our views, our ways of seeing things, our orientations toward things. These also have quite a big influence on what's going on in the present. So, for example, if I carry the view that meditators are generally boring people to talk with, then I am much more likely to be bored at IMC than if I didn't carry that view. In fact, I would walk in with that filter and that would influence my experience here. You know, these people are all probably going to be boring. And so then that lowers the quality of the attention because I'm only attending to part of the picture. Remember that when I talked about what defines high-quality attention, it's that it's fresh and receptive and open to what is actually here. And any kind of a fixed view or idea about what's going on tends to limit and confine what I can see and what I can experience, right? There's a long sutta in the discourses where the Buddha talks about 62 religious and philosophical views that were prevalent in his society. And he's dismissive of all of these views because of the way that they limit the mind, essentially. And he describes them in great detail and the way people, and some of the views are what he calls eel-wriggling views, where you try not to have a view, which is something practitioners do also. And interestingly, the English title of this sutta has been translated the all-embracing net of views, which I like that phrase because views can be a net, very much a net that we get entangled in. And under the influence of some kind of a view that we're carrying into something, we are definitely not live without a net. And it's not that you shouldn't have any views, of course. We have views all the time, and it's important and useful to have discernment and make choices. That's not at all what's being implied here. It's the unexamined and subconscious views that we're carrying around that exert this kind of pernicious, if you will, pernicious influence. So I first talked about carrying a view into a situation, like thinking that people at IMC are going to be boring. But there's another form that views can take in our interactions, and that is that there's something maybe that we've thought about or said previously, and we kind of like it, like we think, oh yeah, that makes sense, I believe that, I like that. And then when the moment arrives in the conversation, we just kind of repeat that. You know, something comes up and something actually gets triggered in our head that says, oh, this is what I feel about issue A. And then we just state our opinion without necessarily responding to what's actually happening in the moment. We're just repeating a recording from our mind, essentially. I've caught myself doing this. And I noticed, I found this quote from the suttas. Someone once asked the Buddha, they came to him and said, when people go to the Blessed One and pose a question, has there already been in the Blessed One's mind the thought, if they come to me and ask me thus, I shall answer thus? Or does that answer occur to the Buddha on the spot? And the Buddha replied, it occurs to me on the spot. So, so there's something to be said for responding freshly in the moment. And not that we always do or can, but it's helpful to know that, you know, one of the aims in practice or the results, possible results of practice, is that we don't know what we're going to say until we say it. We don't know how we're going to respond in a situation until we've taken it in and brought forth from our heart or our mind what is appropriate in that moment. Someone once asked a Zen master to summarize all the teachings in one phrase, and he said, an appropriate response. So, stepping back, we've now talked about various internal conditions that may prevent us from having high quality attention, memories, past associations, views. But these come in anyway. You know, we're not going to not have these arriving in the moment. So the question is, when are they an actual distraction? And, you know, we could say, well, in general, we get distracted by internal events if we don't have enough attentional strength, if you will, in that moment. We have a reaction or a response because of our past or because of views, because we can't hold them, we can't see them, and so they kind of take over, and that pattern is what's acting, not our fresh awareness of the moment. So it's not that we should always exude and act with total calm and equanimity. There are times when, you know, we're going to act quickly or we're going to speak strongly or dynamically. But it's clear over time when we are acting out of compassion or out of wisdom and when we're acting out of a behavior pattern that's from some part of our past. That's something that we can become sensitive to. And of course, just as the case with the internet or the mobile device where sometimes it's possible for it to actually enhance a situation, there are plenty of cases where what's coming up from our past or something that we've thought about can actually be beneficial and serve the situation. But again, it's just like when I was talking with the woman in the hospital, the mobile phone was in service to our conversation. It's possible to have these internal responses going on, be in service to the situation. I was talking with someone a few weeks ago who was about to go on a long retreat, and it was really great. I felt inspired by that, and she was asking me for advice about going on her long retreat. Now, I've been on a lot of long retreats myself, and so just talking with her was bringing up a lot of memories of my own experiences with that. But I was aware that if I was just, you know, sort of falling back into those memories, I might give her advice that was advice that I needed. I wish I had had. So I actually made a little bit of conscious effort to listen very carefully to what it was that she was asking for and what it was that she was expressing as she talked about her concern with going on her on a longer retreat than she'd been on before. And so then once I heard that clearly, once I listened to her, then I could fold in my own experience and I could offer her something that I think was hopefully useful to her and was not just not just something I wanted to say for me, right? So I think that was, that's a case where the past is seen with wisdom and used to enhance a situation. So in hearing all of this, you may begin to wonder, why is it that the mind chooses distraction? You know, why is it that we tend to go for the lower quality attention sometimes, or we allow ourselves to be drawn into the past or the future, or get distracted by a mobile device, something like that? Why do we choose distraction? Possibly because the full scope of what's happening is very intense, or it can be. There's a huge amount of input coming into our system every moment. And truthfully, we don't have control over a lot of it. Practice will teach us this, right? We don't know what sound is going to happen next. We don't know what body sensation is going to happen next. We just don't know what we're going to see next visually as we turn, come around the corner, something. So the mind learns early, and especially when you're, you know, even less attuned to what's going on as a child, then the mind learns early that this is very intense and I don't have control over it, and it devises strategies for avoiding the full scope of reality. Some of these strategies include grabbing what's pleasant and focusing on that, you know, trying to get, trying just to stay within the realm of what feels pleasant and comfortable. Another strategy is to identify what feels unpleasant or uncomfortable and push that away. So find what isn't good and make sure that I avoid that or actively destroy it in some way. And then there's, of course, tuning it out, you know, just not being as fully present or fuzzing over, if you will. There are a variety of options, but these are some of the main modes that the Buddha talked about. However, these ways of dealing with reality eventually bring lots of suffering. And if we're fortunate, the mind becomes willing to try another way, which is learning to handle the flow of experience within attention. And this is practice, learning to handle the flow of experience within attention. Yeah, one way to talk about it. It's not easy, though, to know what we are not seeing. I mean, how would you know? If there's something that your mind is blocking out in some way because it's not part of what your mind wants to handle in the flow of reality, how are you going to know? So this is interesting. This is part of practice, examining the mind with clarity and receptive interest, I think eventually starts to reveal these things. As we become able to handle the amount of reality that we're open to, then the mind decides, okay, we'll open to a little bit more. And then you'll see something else and realize, oh, there's something else here. And This is basically the development of attention, which is, you know, which is what practice can do. One of the dimensions of practice is that it develops our attention. So we learn slowly to see more and more. Andrea Fella says she has this nice phrase, she says, the threshold of consciousness gets lowered. And she doesn't mean like lowered in quality, it just means it goes a little deeper. We can see more deeply into the present moment. In my experience, this brings greater pain in some ways because we open to more of the part of reality that we thought we couldn't handle before. And so there is, you know, and we open to more and more of the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of the totality of the world, that is the First Noble Truth. But with it comes greater ability to be with that. And so there's actually less suffering associated with the greater awareness of dukkha. It's an interesting process. Did you know you signed up for this, by the way? Don't worry, though. My experience is that over time, attention grows in both depth and breadth. So just as an example, the body. Just take the body. A lot of people over time spend a lot of time with their body because they use the breath or the body as a meditation object. And so you just get to know that over time. And at first I can say for me, my body felt pretty much like I saw it in the mirror. Like when I first sat down, I had this image of my body that was what? Well, it was what I had seen my whole life. And so I felt like it was, you know, a certain shape and size, and it was not too differentiated on the inside because I mostly looked at the outside of it in the mirror. And then there were lots of parts that I couldn't feel very well internally. I just had never really thought of, you know, really turned my attention there. Over time, I often use the breath and the body as a meditation object. So over time, I've found that more and more has opened internally, and I feel that the body goes really deeper and deeper, goes very, very deep. Mindfulness can go to a cellular level and really pick out details, or it can even have a broad awareness, but see the body in a different way than we see it in the mirror. So this is a development of depth in attention. And I also find that attention broadens, so I can hold more at the same time. So for example, it's possible to speak and be aware of my body and know that I am knowing all at the same time. And when I began practice, especially when I started working on mindfulness of speech, I realized that I had no awareness of my body while I was speaking at first. It was entirely, I was entirely caught in the words that I was saying and in my head and in my own thoughts. And over time, I learned that actually it's possible to relax out of that and have the speech and the body awareness at the same time. So we can learn that, and we'll also start to see more. We'll start to see our intention before we speak. We'll start to be able to track the thoughts that are flowing in parallel as we're speaking or interacting with something, someone, just like I talked about earlier, those associations from the past or those views coming in. We can learn to kind of track those and hold them in awareness as the breath changes. There are actually exercises that can be done systematically of sitting and taking in the body and then the thoughts and the emotions and the space and, you know, wider. There are other lineages of Buddhism offer practices like this, and these are great. They're great for broadening the awareness. It's even possible to see everything at once. So attention that I'm talking about, this attention is part of the path. It shifts and changes over time. It develops, so something that develops is part of the path. And each moment of mindfulness that we have is an advance. Gil says, no moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. And I think that's true. we may think, oh, big deal, you know, I remembered to be mindful several times during today, but I don't feel any wiser by the end of the day. But it matters. Each of those moments is an advance on the path, if you will. Don't really go backward. I don't know if we really go forward either, but every moment of mindfulness does count. The quality is getting higher and higher on average. So live without a net. Presence, you know, the presence that we bring. It's real. It's a real thing in the world to stand with this kind of presence. There are really lovely phrases that are used for the meditative experience of having very strong presence. Words like sheer clarity. I like that one quite a lot. Naked presence. I think we can feel this in another person. You know, we can feel when someone is fully present without divided attention. It's an act of generosity, actually, to really be able to offer that to someone, and it's a lovely feeling to receive that from someone, taking it all in and not being swayed by the unwholesome reactions or other things happening in the mind. And I would say that as we get used to practicing with attention, practicing with the quality of the attention, noticing that, it can begin to feel like there is no net, actually, or no ground. It begins to feel like there aren't as many fixed reference points and we're just there responding to the situation. It can take some getting used to, but well worth it. And it's so inspiring to be in a room like this where there's a lot of attention. And just maybe you could feel it while sitting, the power of this many people just intending to be present all at the same time together. Very special experience, very unusual in the world, and quite a gift that we're offering to ourselves and to everyone indeed. So I'll stop there, but I would love to hear from anyone with questions or comments or experiences of high quality attention. We have a microphone. Oh, there we go.
Saturday, I was in a meeting with one person at my house for 3 hours and another massage therapist, and we were discussing marketing strategies. And she's on call with a massage company, so her phone was pinging about every 10 minutes during the meeting, and she had to keep watching her iPhone because she had to hit the button to be the first for the job, and it drove me nuts. And what could I do? This was her livelihood, and it's part of the age that we live in. And so I had to make peace with it. But then we both had our computers on our laps, and we were looking for companies on the internet, and when we would find one, she was busy typing on her computer. And I said, I don't think that you're giving me enough of your attention. And she said, well, I'm multitasking. So that is where my question begins, about the value of multitasking and her sense of competence in that situation, as opposed to the quality of attention.
Yeah, so you weren't experiencing high-quality attention from her, is what I'm hearing. And you could tell that, right? Yeah. So you're asking about does multitasking have value?
Multitasking and competence has high value, but it's less quality attention when you're with somebody in a meeting.
Yeah. I'm not sure how successful the mind really is at multitasking. It is, of course, possible to hold many things in attention at once, so we can, you know, as I mentioned at the end, we can multitask speaking and being aware of the body and so forth. But if we're actually trying to do two things at once, it's possible that we do each one slightly less competently. So I'm not sure competence and multitasking go together either. And there's, you know, the reality of a given situation. So if she needed to be on call or so forth, then that was the reality of that situation. The quality of your attention was your responsibility, and it sounds like you were attending to that in some way because you have some sensitivity about that. I don't have an answer for that situation, except that I'm happy to hear that you noticed it and actually pointed it out. You don't know what the effect of that might be on her over time. You know, maybe at that moment she was just defensive or just said, I have to multitask. But maybe that comment planted a seed for her. I don't know.
Well, we're going to be meeting three times next week, so I may start the meeting saying, I would like your full attention as much as possible, in a encouraging kind of not complaining tone of voice, just to put it out there.
Maybe you could suggest that the meeting doesn't have any devices, or at least for the first half an hour it doesn't, and then the experience of that might be a stronger teacher than any words.
I'll try it. Thank you.
Sorry. I've noticed that there seems to be some correlation between physical energy. When I'm tired, I have a harder time holding attention.
Yeah.
Either to lack of sleep or just at the end of a long day. Just wondering if you can offer a little bit of insight into that, if you've thought about it, why the correlation exists.
That's an interesting question because, of course, energy in the body and energy in the mind are different things. As an example, some of us may have been present with someone who is dying, and someone who's dying has almost no energy left in their body, but the power of their mind can be very strongly felt in the room sometimes. And yet, for us who are maybe not dying at this moment, it's definitely true. I've also seen that when the body is physically tired, it's harder for the mind. And I don't know. I think there's, this is the mind-body correlation. When we're not under extraordinary circumstances like might happen at the end of life, then, you know, the body gets tired and the mind gets tired. However, it's interesting to experiment with what can wake the mind up when the body is feeling tired. Sometimes doing things that wake the body up a little bit, even like walking or going outside for fresh air, something like that, can actually wake the mind up a little bit also. Also meditating can wake the mind up, and that's easy to do when the body is tired because it's just sitting still. So I think it helps to bring attention to the body as an object in moments like that and feel, what does this heaviness feel like? What does this tiredness feel like? And then you're brightening the mind around that feeling of tiredness. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but that very brightening of becoming interested, what does tiredness in the body feel like? That alone can start changing the condition of the mind. But sometimes you just need to go to bed or have something to eat. Yeah.
Can I just tag on one question, if you don't mind, to that? So I'm curious to understand the relationship between, again, the physical energy related to fatigue and the mood you experience, because, again, there seems to be a direct correlation between the two. And it's fascinating why there's such a strong correlation between those two.
So I'm guessing that when you're experiencing fatigue or physical low energy, then you're saying that your mind is more susceptible to negative mind states. Is that what you're implying?
That's precisely it, yeah. And the choice of words is absolutely right. You're more susceptible to that.
Right.
As opposed to when you're high energy or you're just not fatigued.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a little bit habitual, is that because this is something I've noticed through my own practice, is that when the mind is actually sad, depressed, frustrated in some way, the physical feeling of that is one of lower energy, of contraction, etc. And so that's the mind influencing the body. So when the body somehow gets itself into a state, say you haven't eaten for 7 or 8 hours and you've been working all day, something like that, then the body has that feeling of tiredness and fatigue, and out of habit, the mind thinks, oh, this is associated with sadness, depression, etc., and can actually relate those two when they don't necessarily, there isn't necessarily an emotional trigger for those feelings. So this is a great time to experiment and find out if that's really true. Am I really feeling sad, or am I actually feeling tired, and that's the physical feeling that I associate with sadness, so I'm triggering my own sadness, yeah? So this is worth looking into. There's a number of ways to do that, but, mindfulness of the mind, seeing if there's actually a cause there. And try being happy instead. Try smiling. You may discover that being tired is actually kind of a feeling of relaxation, which is associated with what? Peace, ease. There's other elements of the tired experience that you can pick up to influence the mind. Yeah.
This might be the last question.
I really rung a bell when you talked about distraction and pain. I spent a lot of my life trying to medicate pain by sometimes extreme forms of distraction, and it wasn't until I finally started embracing the pain, and that caused, as you said, it caused suffering to just compound. And it wasn't just till I actually first got exposed to Buddhism and started noticing that if I embrace the pain, the suffering goes down. It's not that I want pain, but if I just accept the pain that's already there, then the suffering goes down, and I finally realize that pain is really nothing. It's I can live with the pain.
Mm.
It's the suffering engendered by the way I was handling it that that made life hell.
Thank you. That's a good insight. Okay, so we'll finish here. We're at the end of our time. We can take one more. If anybody needs to leave, that's okay.
Sorry, that was a very interesting conversation, I think. I've been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, and I think to a varying degree we may all have those issues, especially in this culture. But it seems like what you're saying is that these things that we can bring in that can be viewed as distractions are only distractions if we're not aware of them. And what I find myself, as I meditate, I find myself being able to catch when I was not aware, but I'm having a tougher time staying present with those. Let's say I'm bringing in a view or a belief, staying present with knowing that I'm bringing that in, mm-hmm. versus knowing that I just did that.
Uh-huh. That's fine. Retrospective knowledge is almost just as good, and it grows toward more present moment knowledge, or even foreknowledge. The feeling like something is about to come in. The things that we're working with in our mind, the ways that it gets distracted or grabs onto things, we're going to have all kinds of relationships with those. Sometimes it's we just see the after it's already happened. Sometimes over time we start to see it as it's happening, but we still don't have control and it just unfolds. And other times we see it and we can have the attentional strength not to go into it. It's a whole process. And I think it's dangerous to start cataloging and saying this one I can do and this one I can't do and this one it's been 3 weeks and I still can't, you know, etc. But, you know, the degree of awareness that you're talking about is already more than just being completely lost. And it's a process over time to learn about our mind. And I have great faith in mindfulness as finding the way to the end of suffering, to not suffering from a certain thing in creative ways. We don't know what it's going to look like, but the mind is going to find a way to let go if there's mindfulness there. Yeah. So, thank you, everyone.